From IntelliJix, this is IntelliJix World Religions, an educational look at the world's religions. This show neither endorses nor rejects any belief. By the end of this episode, you will have a working understanding of how Hinduism developed across thousands of years of history, what its foundational concepts of Dharma, Karma, Moksha, and Samsara actually mean to the people who hold them, how the great deity traditions of Vaishnavism, Shaivism, and Shaktism understand the divine, and why Hinduism's extraordinary. Today, we are stepping into what many scholars describe as the oldest living religious tradition on earth. A tradition so vast, so internally diverse, and so philosophically rich that even defining it precisely has become one of the more interesting academic debates of our time. Philosophical range, from radical non-dualism to intensely personal devotion, is not a contradiction, but perhaps the tradition's most defining feature. We will travel from the banks of the ancient Indus River to the living temples and households of the present day. Let us begin. One of the first things any honest student of Hinduism encounters is a definitional puzzle. The word Hinduism itself is a relatively modern construction. The term derives from Hindu, which comes from Sindhu, the Sanskrit name for the Indus River. Persian and later Greek travelers used variations of this geographical term to describe the people living beyond the river. Over centuries, through contact with Islamic rulers and eventually British colonial administrators, the word gradually became applied to the extraordinarily varied religious landscape of the Indian subcontinent. Many scholars today note that what we call Hinduism was never, historically, a single organized religion, in the way that term is often understood in the modern West. Rather, it is an umbrella that shelters an enormous family of related traditions, philosophies, and practices, some of which differ from each other as dramatically as they resemble each other. Some practitioners prefer to use the Sanskrit phrase Sanatana Dharma, meaning something like the eternal order or the eternal way of righteousness, as a more authentic self-description. Others are comfortable with Hinduism as a useful, if imperfect, shorthand. Keeping that complexity in mind from the very start will serve us well throughout this conversation. Scholars trace the earliest identifiable roots of what will become Hinduism to the Indus Valley civilization, which flourished in the region of modern Pakistan and northwestern India roughly between 3000 and 1500 BCE. Archaeological excavations at sites like Mohenjo-Daro and Harappa have uncovered seals depicting figures that some researchers tentatively connect to later Hindu imagery. A figure in what might be a meditative posture that some have linked to early Shiva iconography, and evidence of ritual bathing pools that could prefigure later Hindu purification practices. However, scholars are careful to note that these connections remain speculative, since the Indus Valley script has not been deciphered, and drawing direct lines between this ancient urban civilization and later religious traditions involves significant interpretive leaps. The debate remains genuinely open. What is on firmer scholarly ground is the immense importance of the Vedic period, generally dated from roughly 1500 BCE onward, though these dates themselves are contested. Some traditional Hindu scholars argue for much older origins. The Vedas are the foundational sacred texts of the Brahmanical tradition that forms one of Hinduism's deepest roots. There are four Vedas, the Rigveda, the Samaveda, the Yajurveda, and the Atharvaveda. The Rigveda, a collection of over 1,000 hymns, is among the oldest surviving religious texts in any Indo-European language. These hymns address a pantheon of deities: Indra, the storm god and king of the gods, Agni, the god of fire who mediates between humans and the divine, Varuna, the upholder of cosmic order, Surya, the sun, Ushas, the dawn, and many others. The Vedic religious world centered significantly on ritual complex, precisely performed fire sacrifices called yajna, carried out by specialized priests called Brahmins, through which adherents sought to maintain cosmic order and secure divine favor. The Vedic worldview also introduced a concept that would prove foundational to everything that followed: the idea of Rita, cosmic order and truth. Maintaining Rita through proper ritual and right conduct was understood as essential to the harmony of the universe itself. You can hear in Rita the deep ancestor of what will later become the concept of Dharma. The Vedas were considered Shruti, that which is heard or revealed, understood by tradition as eternal truths perceived by ancient seers called rishis in states of deep insight. This divine origin gave them an authority that Hindu tradition has largely maintained across millennia. Between roughly 800 and 200 BCE, a remarkable philosophical turn occurred within the Vedic tradition. The texts known as the Upanishads. There are traditionally 108, though scholars identify an earlier core group of perhaps a dozen as the principal ones, began to move the tradition's center of gravity from elaborate external ritual toward interior inquiry and metaphysical speculation. The Upanishads ask questions that will shape Indian thought for thousands of years. What is the ultimate nature of reality? What is the self? What is the relationship between the individual and the cosmos? What causes suffering, and how can it be transcended? The answers the Upanishads develop are among the most philosophically ambitious in human history. Two concepts above all others become central. The first is Brahman, the ultimate, infinite, self-existent ground of all reality, beyond form, beyond description, the source and substance of everything that exists. The second is Atman, the innermost self, the true I at the center of each individual being, not the body, not the mind, not the personality, but the pure witnessing consciousness beneath all of these. And then comes what many consider the most radical philosophical claim of the Upanishads. Atman and Brahman are, in their deepest nature, identical. The individual self and the universal ground of being are, at the most fundamental level, one. The famous formula, Tat Tivamasi, that thou art, from the Shandajiya Upanishad, points directly to this identity. This insight will become the cornerstone of one of Hinduism's greatest philosophical schools, as we will discuss. Alongside these philosophical developments, the period from roughly 500 BCE onward saw the emergence and gradual growth of what will become the great deity traditions that define much of lived Hinduism today. The Mahabharata and the Ramayana, the two great Sanskrit epics, take shape over centuries during this period and become perhaps the most culturally influential texts in all of South Asian civilization. The Mahabharata, the longer of the two and reputedly the longest poem ever composed, contains within it the Bhagavad Gita, a text of such importance that it is difficult to overstate. The Gita presents a conversation between the warrior Arjuna, who stands paralyzed with moral crisis on a battlefield, and his charioteer Krishna, who is revealed to be the supreme being in human form. Across 18 chapters, the Gita expounds on Dharma, the nature of the self, the paths to liberation, and the relationship between the individual and the divine with a philosophical richness and emotional depth that has captivated readers for centuries and continues to do so today. The Ramayana, attributed by tradition to the poet Valmiki, tells the story of Rama, an avatara or divine descent of Vishnu, his devoted wife Sita, his faithful brother Lakshmana, and the devoted helper Hanuman, as Rama struggles to rescue Sita from the demon king Ravana. The Ramayana has shaped conceptions of duty, honor, devotion, and ideal conduct across South and Southeast Asia in ways that are still very much alive in contemporary culture. Both epics, along with the Puranas, a vast body of later Sanskrit texts that elaborate the mythologies of the various deity traditions, function as what scholars sometimes call Smriti, that which is remembered, texts of great authority but, in traditional terms, of a different order than the revealed Vedas. Now let us turn to those foundational concepts that any conversation about Hinduism must address. Dharma is perhaps the most important and most difficult to translate. It derives from a Sanskrit root meaning to uphold or sustain, and it encompasses ideas of cosmic order, moral law, religious duty, right conduct, and social obligation all at once. In the Vedic context, Dharma maintains the order of the cosmos. In the social and ethical context, Dharma prescribes how one ought to act according to one's position in life, one's stage of life, one's community, and the specific circumstances of a situation. The Bhagavad Gita wrestles profoundly with Dharma. Arjuna's crisis is precisely a crisis of Dharma, a conflict between different legitimate duties. One important traditional concept is that of Svadharma, one's own particular duty, which may differ from the duties of another. Different persons in different circumstances may have different dharmic obligations. This is why Hinduism has often resisted a single universal moral code, applicable identically to all people in all circumstances. A feature that outside observers have sometimes found puzzling, but which makes deep internal sense within the tradition's logic. Karma is another concept of enormous importance, one that has entered global popular culture, often in simplified forms that don't fully capture its original meaning. In Hindu philosophical understanding, karma refers to action, but specifically to action understood as having consequences that bind the actor. Every intentional action, whether physical, verbal, or mental, generates karmic effects. These effects may not manifest immediately. They may carry forward across multiple lifetimes. The crucial nuance is that it is not merely the external action but the intention and the attachment behind it that generates karma. Acting from desire, from ego, from ignorance, this is what creates binding karma. Acting rightly, from duty, without attachment to results, the Bhagavad Gita's famous concept of nishkama karma, desireless action, this does not bind the actor in the same way. Karma is not understood in traditional Hindu thought as a punitive system imposed from outside, but as a natural moral law, as inherent to the structure of reality as physical causation. Samsara is the cycle of death and rebirth that karma perpetuates. The self, the Atman, is understood in most Hindu traditions as eternal, neither created nor destroyed. But in its conditioned state, obscured by ignorance and bound by karma, it passes through successive lifetimes, taking on different bodies, different circumstances, different experiences. Samsara is not, on this view, simply a sequence of pleasant second chances. It is understood as fundamentally characterized by dukkha, by suffering, impermanence, and limitation, however pleasant any particular life might seem. The recognition of samsara's ultimate unsatisfactoriness is what motivates the spiritual quest, and that quest aims at moksha, liberation. Moksha is release from the cycle of samsara, freedom from the bondage of karma and ignorance, the attainment of the soul's true nature. Different Hindu philosophical schools understand exactly what moksha means in somewhat different ways, as we will explore. But across these differences, the orientation is consistent. The highest human aspiration is not mere happiness or worldly success, but liberation, the realization of one's deepest nature and the end of conditioned existence. This fourfold framework, Dharma, Karma, Samsara, and Moksha, along with the related goal of Artha, material welfare, and Kama, legitimate pleasure, which together with Moksha and Dharma constitute what tradition calls the four aims of human life, or Purusharthas, provides the basic architecture within which an enormous variety of Hindu religious paths make sense. Let us now turn to the great deity traditions, because lived Hinduism is inseparable from its extraordinary devotional life. Here a common misconception deserves direct attention. Hinduism is sometimes described in popular discourse as polytheistic, in a way that implies a simple plurality of separate gods. But this framing misses the subtlety of how most Hindu traditions actually understand the divine. Many, perhaps most, Hindu theological frameworks, however they differ in other respects, hold that the many deities are understood as manifestations, aspects, or expressions of a single ultimate divine reality, whether that ultimate is understood as a personal God or an impersonal ground of being. The philosopher Swami Vivekananda, speaking in the late 19th century, articulated a version of this view memorably. The many gods of Hinduism are like the many names and forms through which the infinite is approached by finite minds. This is a widely held theological position within the tradition itself, though it is not the only one. Some traditions maintain robust distinctions between deities and the ultimate. Vaishnavism is the tradition centered on Vishnu as the supreme being. Adherents hold that Vishnu is not simply one god among many, but the ultimate personal god, the source and sustainer of all existence. One of the most theologically significant concepts in Vaishnavism is that of the avatar, from Sanskrit avatara, meaning descent. When Dharma declines and the world is threatened, Vishnu descends into the world in a particular form to restore order. The tradition classically enumerates 10 principal avatars, though lists vary. Among them are Matsya the fish, Kurma the tortoise, and in later forms the human descents of Rama and Krishna, who are among the most beloved figures in all of Hindu devotion. Krishna, as presented in the Bhagavad Gita, and especially in the Bhagavata Purana, a Sanskrit text of extraordinary poetic and devotional richness, is understood not merely as a divine descent, but as the very fullest self-manifestation of the Supreme. The Bhagavata Purana's 10th book, narrating Krishna's life from his miraculous birth through his childhood in the pastoral community of Vrindavan to his teachings and cosmic revelations, has inspired an ocean of poetry, music, dance, visual art, and devotional practice across South and Southeast Asia. Within Vaishnavism, the concept of bhakti, devotional love for God, reaches its most elaborate theological development. Bhakti is not merely emotional religiosity. Vaishnava theologians have developed sophisticated frameworks for understanding the varieties and stages of devotional love, the relationship between the devotee and the divine, and how bhakti itself functions as a path to liberation. The great bhakti movements that swept across India from roughly the 6th century CE onward, and with renewed intensity from the 12th to 17th centuries, produced some of the most beloved religious poetry in any language. Figures like Andal, Murabai, Tukaram, Sirdas, and Kabir, some of whose teachings straddled Hindu and Islamic devotional traditions in fascinating ways, composed devotional poetry of such beauty and spiritual urgency that it continues to be sung, recited, and treasured today. The bhakti poets often broke with caste convention in significant ways, insisting that divine love is available to all regardless of social station. Scholars note that these movements had complex social dimensions, sometimes serving as vehicles for lower caste and women's voices that might otherwise have been marginalized. Shaivism centers on Shiva as the ultimate divine reality. Shiva is a deity of extraordinary complexity and apparent paradox, a paradox that many Shaiva theologians argue reveals something essential about the nature of ultimate reality. Shiva is simultaneously the great ascetic, the Lord of Yoga, seated in deep meditation on Mount Kailash, and the passionate divine consort, the cosmic dancer whose dance, the Tandava, simultaneously destroys and regenerates the universe. Shiva is both destroyer and the very source of life. Shiva is often depicted with the crescent moon in his matted hair, the Ganges River flowing from his locks, holding a trident, accompanied by his bull Nandi, his body smeared with ash. The ash is significant, a reminder of death and impermanence, and of the ascetic's transcendence of ordinary concerns. The divine lingam, or pillar of light, is the most common form in which Shiva is worshipped in temples, understood theologically by most Shaiva traditions not as mere fertility symbolism, but as an aniconic representation of the infinite divine reality that transcends all form while being the source of all form. Kashmir Shaivism is one of the most philosophically sophisticated schools within the broader Shaiva world, holding that Shiva, pure, self-luminous consciousness, is the sole ultimate reality, and that the entire universe is Shiva's own self-expression, a play of divine consciousness with itself. This is a non-dual position of considerable philosophical depth. Shaiva Siddhanta, influential particularly in South India and among Tamil communities, takes a more qualified view, maintaining meaningful distinctions between God, souls, and the world, even as it emphasizes liberation through Shiva's grace. The Tamil Shaiva tradition has produced one of the world's great devotional literatures in the Tevaram, hymns by the Nayanmars, 63 saints whose passionate songs to Shiva are among the most celebrated religious poetry in the Tamil language. She is worshipped in many forms as the serene and benevolent Parvati, the devoted wife and divine mother, as Durga, the warrior goddess who battles cosmic evil, as the fierce and terrible Kali standing on the prostrate body of Shiva, garlanded with skulls, embodying the raw power of time and transformation, as Saraswati, goddess of learning and the arts, as Lakshmi, goddess. Shaktism takes as its ultimate focus the goddess Shakti, the divine feminine power that adherents hold, is the very energy through which all reality comes into being and is sustained. The goddess is understood in Shaktism not as subordinate to a male deity, but as the ultimate reality herself, or at minimum as equal in primacy, of prosperity and grace, and as the 10 Mahavidyas, a group of 10 tantric goddess forms of particular importance in certain traditions. The Divi Mahatmya, embedded in the Markandeya Purana, is a fundamental Shakta scripture in which the goddess battles and defeats cosmic demons, a narrative understood theologically as depicting the divine power that underlies and overcomes the forces of ignorance and ego. Tantric traditions, which have connections to all three of these major streams as well as to certain Buddhist traditions, deserve brief mention here. Tantra is a Sanskrit term referring to certain ritual and meditative traditions that emphasize the body as a vehicle for liberation. The use of mantra and yantra, sacred sound, and sacred geometric diagrams. And in some traditions, the ritual use of elements that conventional religion prohibits. Tantra has been significantly sensationalized and misunderstood in Western popular culture, where it has been disproportionately associated with sexuality. While some tantric traditions do involve carefully ritualized transgression of social norms as a means of transcending attachment and ego, this represents one strand among many. Now let us enter the remarkable world of Hindu philosophical schools, the darshanas, meaning viewpoints or visions. Hindu philosophical tradition recognizes 6 classical darshanas, all of which are understood as grounded in the Vedas. Nyaya, logic and epistemology. Vaisheshika, atomistic analysis of reality. Samkhya, a dualistic framework distinguishing pure. Scholars note that tantric traditions made enormous contributions to Hindu philosophy, ritual, and art, and that their internal diversity is as great as that of Hinduism more broadly. Consciousness from matter. Yoga, closely related to Samkhya, with a detailed path of practice. Mimamsa, focused on Vedic ritual and the philosophy of language. And Vedanta, concerned with interpreting the Upanishads and the nature of Brahman. Of these, Vedanta has had perhaps the greatest influence on subsequent Hindu thought, and its internal divisions represent some of the most significant theological debates within the tradition. The phenomenal world of multiplicity, the apparent existence of individual selves distinct from each other and from Brahman, all of this is characterized by Shankara using the concept of Maya, not illusion in the simple sense that the world is unreal, but rather that the world as ordinarily perceived, as a collection of independently existing separate things, does not. Advaita Vedanta, non-dual Vedanta, as systematized by the philosopher Adi Shankaracharya in the 8th and 9th century CE, represents one of the boldest philosophical positions in human intellectual history. On Shankara's view, Brahman, pure, undifferentiated consciousness, is the sole ultimate reality, represent ultimate reality, Brahman alone is ultimately real. The appearance of multiplicity is the result of ignorance, avidya, and liberation, consists in the direct recognition that one's own Atman is identical with Brahman. There is, ultimately, only one. Shankara's framework was enormously influential, both within India and in Western philosophical encounters with Hindu thought. But it did not go unchallenged within the tradition. Ramanuja, the great 11th and 12th century Vaishnava philosopher, developed a position he called Vishishtadvaita, qualified non-dualism. Ramanuja agreed that Brahman is ultimately one, but he insisted on the reality of individual selves and the material world as genuine distinctions within that one reality, not illusions, but as it were, the body of Brahman. On Ramanuja's view, Brahman is not a featureless absolute but is identical with Vishnu, a personal god with infinite attributes, whose grace is essential to liberation. The devotee's relationship with God is real, not something to be dissolved. Liberation, for Ramanuja, is not the dissolution of individuality into an undifferentiated absolute, but rather a state of profound communion with God, while retaining one's individual nature. Ramanuja's philosophy provided a sophisticated theological foundation for the Vaishnava Bhakti traditions that came after him. Madhva, the 13th century Vaishnava philosopher, pushed further still into what he called Dvaita, dualism. Madhva argued that the differences between God, individual souls, and the material world are real, eternal, and irreducible, not to be explained away by any concept of non-difference. Vishnu, the souls, and the world remain genuinely distinct even in liberation. This position has its own theological coherence and has sustained a living philosophical and devotional tradition, particularly in Karnataka in South India. The diversity of these philosophical positions, and there are others we have not had time to discuss, including the schools of Kashmir Shaivism, the Shaiva Siddhanta, the Charvaka materialist tradition, and many more, illustrates something essential about Hinduism's intellectual character. The tradition has historically valued philosophical debate and tolerated, indeed, celebrated, a pluralism of viewpoints that would be unusual in more doctrinally unified traditions. The concept of adhikara, meaning roughly suitability or qualification, has sometimes been invoked to explain this pluralism. Different teachings and practices are appropriate for different types of people at different stages of development. This is not merely relativism. Within each school, truth claims are made with great seriousness. But the overall cultural orientation toward philosophical diversity has shaped Hinduism in profound ways. Turning to practices, rituals, and community life, the diversity we have been describing at the philosophical level extends equally to how Hindus practice their faith. Yet certain common threads run through this diversity. Puja, ritual worship, is perhaps the most universal and fundamental practice of Hindu life. Puja involves honoring a divine image or murti, which is not understood in most traditions as a mere symbol, but as an actual locus of the deity's presence, invited and sustained through ritual. The image is treated with the hospitality one would show an honored guest, bathed, clothed, offered food, incense, flowers, light. This ritual act of offering upachara is understood as a form of relationship, of service, of love. In temples, puja is performed by priests trained in specific ritual lineages. At home, family members maintain household shrines where daily puja is performed. The experience of darshan, literally seeing, the act of standing in the presence of the deity and being seen by the deity in return, is understood as spiritually significant and often deeply moving for devotees. Pilgrimage, Tirtha Yatra, holds a central place in Hindu religious life. India and Nepal are dotted with pilgrimage sites of enormous sacred significance. The city of Varanasi, also called Benares or Kashi, on the banks of the Ganges River, is considered by many Hindus to be the most sacred city on earth, a place where, according to devotional belief, dying grants liberation. The Kumbh Mela, the great gathering of pilgrims that rotates among four sacred cities according to astrological configurations, is the largest peaceful human gathering on Earth, drawing tens of millions of pilgrims. The Char Dham, four sacred destinations spread across India, represents a pilgrimage circuit that many devout Hindus aspire to complete in a lifetime. These pilgrimages are not merely tourist journeys. They are understood as spiritually transformative, as acts of devotion, as opportunities to accumulate merit and purify karma. Festivals punctuate the Hindu calendar with extraordinary richness. Diwali, the festival of lights, celebrated in autumn, marks among other narratives the return of Rama from exile and his victory over evil, and is observed across Hindu communities worldwide as a time of illuminating lamps, sharing sweets, and celebrating the triumph of light over darkness. Holi, the spring festival, is an exuberant celebration involving colored powders and water, associated with the story of the devotee Prahlad and the divine grace that protected him, and with Krishna's playful interactions with his devotees. Navaratri, nine nights, celebrated twice yearly, honors the goddess in her various forms. Mahashivaratri, the great night of Shiva, is a night of fasting, vigil, and worship particularly important to Shaiva devotees. Each of these festivals has its own regional variations, its own local stories, its own particular customs. The lived texture of Hindu religious life is profoundly regional and familial, with significant variation from one part of India to another, and further variation in diaspora communities around the world. The ashramas, the traditional four stages of life, student, householder, forest dweller, and renunciant, represent an ideal framework within which the four aims of human life are to be pursued in proper sequence. The householder stage, far from being understood as spiritually inferior, is in many traditions honored as foundational. Family life, social responsibility, legitimate enjoyment, and material prosperity are all understood as proper aspects of a full human life within Dharmic order. The renunciant stage, sannyasa, involves withdrawal from worldly obligations in the fullest pursuit of liberation. In practice, relatively few Hindus follow this exact fourfold schema, but it represents an important cultural and normative framework. The institution of the guru, the spiritual teacher, is of immense importance in Hindu tradition. The relationship between guru and disciple is understood in many traditions as among the most sacred human relationships, the means by which authentic spiritual knowledge is transmitted from teacher to student in an unbroken lineage. This lineage, the parampara, is understood as guaranteeing the authenticity and potency of the teachings. Guru Purnima, a full moon day in summer, is observed as a day of honoring one's spiritual teacher. The importance of the guru has sometimes created conditions in which charismatic leaders have been granted enormous authority, a dynamic that, scholars note, has occasionally had problematic consequences in cases of abuse of that authority, a contemporary issue we will return to. On the question of internal diversity, it is important to be clear that Hinduism has no single central authority, no pope, no universal council, no creed that all Hindus must affirm. Various traditional institutions. The Shankaracharya Mathas, established by Adi Shankaracharya at four corners of India, various temple trusts, the Vishwa Hindu Parishad in the political sphere, prominent swamis and their organizations, exercise influence within parts of the community, but none commands universal obedience. This decentralized structure has been both a source of Hinduism's remarkable adaptability and, at times, a source of difficulty in presenting coherent public positions on contested issues. Caste, the Varna system, and the Jati system is one of the most important and most contested dimensions of Hindu social reality, and it cannot be passed over. The traditional Varna framework divides society into four categories: Brahmins, priests, and scholars; Kshatriyas, warriors, and rulers; Vaishyas, merchants and farmers, and Shudras, laborers and service providers. However, reformers both ancient and modern have challenged caste hierarchy from within Hindu frameworks. The Bhakti saints often explicitly defied caste boundaries. The philosopher Basavanna in 12th century Karnataka challenged caste discrimination radically. And modern reform movements from Swami Vivekananda to B.R. Ambedkar, though Ambedkar ultimately renounced Hinduism. Outside this fourfold system are those historically called untouchables, now preferring terms like Dalit, meaning oppressed, whose communities have faced severe discrimination and social exclusion, justified at times by appeals to dharmic order and karma. Many traditional texts present caste as a divinely ordained social order. For Buddhism, in protest against caste oppression, have engaged the question of caste in profound ways. The Indian Constitution, shaped significantly by Ambedkar, prohibits caste discrimination. Caste continues to be debated vigorously within Hindu communities and within Indian society. Its religious dimensions, its social reality, its persistence despite legal prohibition, and its interpretation are all contested. Scholars note that caste cannot be understood simply as a religious phenomenon. It has deep social, economic, and political dimensions that interact in complex ways with religious frameworks. Contemporary Hinduism faces a range of significant issues that scholars, practitioners, and observers are actively engaging. The rise of Hindu nationalism, Hindutva, meaning roughly Hinduness, is one of the most consequential and controversial. Hindutva as a political ideology, associated with figures like Vinayak Damodar Savarkar and organizational expressions like the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh and the Bharatiya Janata Party, defines Indian national identity in terms of Hindu cultural heritage in ways that critics argue marginalize India's Muslim, Christian, and other minority communities. Supporters argue they are defending Hindu civilization and culture from historical injuries and present threats. The relationship between Hinduism as a religious tradition and Hindutva as a political ideology is itself contested. Many Hindu religious leaders and scholars insist that the spiritual universalism they find in the tradition is fundamentally incompatible with the exclusivism of Hindutva, while others within the tradition find points of alignment. This is an active, ongoing, and often heated debate within Indian society and among diaspora communities worldwide. The experience of Hinduism in diaspora in the United States, United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, Southeast Asia, the Caribbean, and elsewhere represents another significant contemporary development. Hindu diaspora communities have navigated complex questions of preservation, adaptation, and identity. Temples in Houston, Leicester, Toronto, and Bali each represent different negotiations between tradition and new context. Second and third generation diaspora Hindus often engage their tradition differently than their grandparents did, sometimes through increased participation in formal religious instruction, sometimes through yoga and meditation practices that may or may not retain explicit Hindu framing, sometimes through a distilled or intellectualized engagement with Vedantic philosophy. The global spread of yoga and meditation, often stripped of their Hindu religious context, has generated debate about what some scholars and activists call cultural appropriation. While others see the global spread of these practices as a natural and positive development, these conversations reflect deep questions about how living traditions evolve, adapt, and maintain integrity across time and cultural contexts. Gender and sexuality within Hindu traditions are also areas of active scholarly and community discussion. Traditional social structures within Hinduism have often assigned women subordinate roles, though Hindu traditions simultaneously include some of the world's most powerful goddess traditions and a history of female saints, scholars, and renunciants. Reform movements beginning in the 19th century challenged practices like sati, widow immolation, and child marriage, movements both internally generated and influenced by colonial contact, contemporary feminist scholars and practitioners are examining which aspects of the tradition support women's agency and authority, and which have constrained it, with considerable nuance and ongoing debate. On sexuality, Hindu tradition is complex. Classical texts like the Kama Sutra treat human sexuality with philosophical seriousness. Temple sculpture at sites like Khajuraho includes explicitly erotic imagery in sacred contexts, and some scholars identify space within Hindu frameworks for understanding gender and sexual diversity. Yet dominant social norms in many Hindu communities have also supported traditional heteronormativity and stigmatized sexual minorities. Hinduism's decentralized nature means that different communities and leaders take quite different positions on these questions. From a scholarly perspective, the study of Hinduism has itself undergone significant evolution. Colonial-era scholarship often approached Hindu texts and traditions through frameworks derived from Christian categories, looking for doctrine, a founder, a creed, a clear boundary between insider and outsider, frameworks that often distorted what they claimed to describe. The field has worked through several decades of critical reflection on these methodological legacies. Scholars like Wendy Doniger have argued for attending to the full complexity and sometimes transgressive dimensions of Hindu mythology and practice, while others, including many Hindu scholars and community voices, have pushed back against what they see as reductive or disrespectful interpretations. Rajiv Malhotra and others have argued that Western academic frameworks fundamentally misunderstand Hinduism and called for what they term decolonization of Hindu studies. These debates about methodology, representation, and who has authority to interpret a tradition are alive and important. Scholars today generally try to attend carefully to insider perspectives, to represent the tradition's self-understanding with seriousness, while also bringing critical historical and comparative tools to bear. Recognizing that both insider and outsider perspectives have genuine contributions to make and genuine limitations, it is worth pausing to note the incredible range of what the encounter with Hinduism has given to human civilization. The philosophical traditions of Vedanta, Yoga, Samkhya, and Kashmir Shaivism have contributed concepts. The nature of consciousness, the relationship between self and world, the analysis of mind and cognition that philosophers worldwide are still grappling with. The mathematical contributions of ancient India, including the decimal system and the concept of zero, developed in a civilization deeply shaped by Hindu thought. Sanskrit literature, from the epics to the Puranas to devotional poetry to philosophical commentary, represents a cultural achievement of the first order. Indian classical music, dance, sculpture, and architecture, from the cave temples of Ellora and Ajanta to the soaring temple towers of Madurai and Brihadiswara to the intricate devotional bronze casting of the Chola period, are among the world's great artistic traditions, inseparable from their religious context. As we come toward our closing, let us return to where we began, the question of definition. Is Hinduism one religion or many? Is it possible to identify what Hinduism essentially is, or must we content ourselves with describing a family of resemblances? Scholars have offered various answers. Some, like the philosopher S.N. Balagangadhara, have questioned whether religion is even the right category. Others, like Gavin Flood, have tried to identify family resemblances that link the varied traditions without flattening their differences. Perhaps what is most striking and most worth sitting with is that a tradition that encompasses the strict monism of Advaita Vedanta and the devotional dualism of Madhva school, that honors the cosmic dancer Shiva and the utterly transcendent Brahman beyond all qualities, that produced both the rigorous intellectual philosophy of the Nyaya school and the ecstatic poetry of. Practitioners themselves range from those who embrace Hinduism as a unified tradition to those who identify primarily with a specific sampradaya, lineage, or denomination, and to those for whom Hindu is primarily a cultural rather than religious identity. Mirabai's singing of her love for Krishna that offers a path through ritual, a path through knowledge, and a path through devotion, and insists that all three can lead to the same ultimate freedom, has managed to sustain its vitality and its internal conversation for thousands of years. Today we have moved from the hymns of the Rigveda to the philosophical heights of the Upanishads, from the battlefield dialogue of the Bhagavad Gita to the songs of the Bhakti saints, from the towering metaphysics of Shankara to the living practices of puja and pilgrimage, from the ancient world of Vedic sacrifice to the contemporary debates about caste, nationalism, and whatever else one says about Hinduism. This is a tradition that has taken the diversity of human experience and human approaches to the ultimate with extraordinary seriousness. Diaspora identity. We have encountered Vishnu and Shiva and the goddess, the concepts of Dharma and Karma and Samsara and Moksha, the Darshanas and their remarkable philosophical debates. If this conversation has left you with more questions than you arrived with, that may be exactly the right response, because the tradition we have been examining has, for thousands of years, cultivated exactly that spirit. The spirit of inquiry, of Dvandva tolerance, the capacity to hold paradox, and of the recognition that ultimate reality may be larger than any single. We have tried to do so with the curiosity and respect this extraordinary tradition deserves, and with the care about complexity that honest engagement requires. Thank you for spending this time exploring Hinduism with us. Description of it. From IntelliJix, this has been IntelliJix World Religions.